Okay, hi, I am Brian Cardell. I am a developer advocate at Egalia.
I'm Eric Meyer, also a developer advocate at Egalia.
And I'm Ochoa, also a developer advocate at Egalia.
Woohoo, trifecta.
Right.
So Ujwal has been writing a couple of pieces on ECMA. Do you want to talk about what those are talking about?
Sure. So, you know, like ECMA, even by the name, sounds scary. I can't imagine how people who have never worked with it perceive it. But, you know, like I just wanted to give people sort of an insight into how it works, why it's important, and like...
Yeah, so you've been writing those pieces, and then for various reasons, some of which we'll get into, we've been having among ourselves a lot of discussions about W3C and WCAG and standards organizations in general, like SDOs, and like comparing them and contrasting them and thinking about how they work and how they've changed over time and how they've stayed the same. So we thought that could be an interesting show to talk about. One of the things that I thought was really interesting when we were talking about this is that we were talking about like SDOs, standards development organizations. And did you read Tim Berners-Lee's Weaving the Web?
Long time ago.
Yeah. So in it, I'm going to kind of paraphrase, but in it, he, you know, like W3C has this idea of REC. I don't know. Can you like explain that, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, all of the standards that we think of as like the standard etched in stone are, first of all, not really etched in stone, but second of all, are recommendations. There is no like requirement or mandate or anything that comes out of the W3C. So recommendation is kind of the end of the process. And you start with various stages, but eventually you get to recommendation, which requires... Well, at least in the CSS working group, generally requires two interoperable implementations at a minimum, and some other stuff. But
yeah, so it's an interesting thing when you look at like HTML, like it says the HTML standard, like it says right there, the HTML standard.
The what WG HTML standard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like when they're originally setting up the W3C, they consciously did not call it standards. And in his book, he explains that like they didn't think that they wanted some kind of like to claim some top-down authority on the web or risk being seen as some kind of regulatory body and fall into different kinds of traps. They thought that it might create this like tension where the companies that were most involved would see W3C as a gatekeeper rather than a help, you know.
A facilitator.
Yeah. A facilitator, yeah. And so he explained that the recommendation was chosen as the term because it emphasizes consensus and signals that W3C is like offering guidance and not imposing rules. And it was meant to reflect the web's architecture of voluntary adoption and interoperability. It still is thought of as a standard, right? Like regardless of what they wanted to do. Yeah, so it would be interesting then to also compare ECMA and ECMA's history, because ECMA was you know, around pre-WCAG, early standards. I think 1998, I think, is the first. Do you happen to know, Ujwal, what is the...
Yeah. I think the first published version was 98, and I think it was written a bit sooner than that.
It was weird, though, the first one, because I don't know. Did you have any experience? I don't mean to date you or anything or date myself, but like Flash had a language that it used called ActionScript. Did you ever use this?
Yeah. I mean, it was the best way to make video games at the time, right?
So ostensibly that was also ECMAScript, which is weird because they were pretty different. There's interesting stories about that. I'm curious, I don't want to like put you on the spot about asking historical questions for when you weren't there or anything. So like, when did you like join and like what amount of the history do you know?
Oh, I joined EC39 around 2019. So okay. Around the time that Temporal and Into were taking off, but
okay. So, like, what I can remember from, like, firsthand experiences, there was this period where sort of the web is cool, it's new, it's something we've never seen before, it's really taking off in ways that are unbelievable, but we don't, like, kind of nobody really knows where it's going, and, like, even most of the people in W3C are sort of imagining there might be something else, and what if JavaScript, but typed and with classes, you know, and they imagined this JavaScript 2 thing. I think it was mainly Adobe was leading it because, you know, they wanted it to power Flash's future. And Mozilla actually was sort of behind it because they had the Tamarin engine donated to them, which like supported this. So Mozilla was like, cool, let's do it. But Microsoft and, well, it was basically Microsoft was the other player in the game that had any real weight. But also like Yahoo and some big sites that were involved were like opposed to that. And that period dragged on for like a long time. So there's like, there is this long period in history of the web where both in JavaScript and in HTML and CS, like the world was just kind of stalled, right? Like part of it was political, part of it was pragmatic, but yeah. Anyway, like they ended up eventually brokering this like much smaller thing that didn't include any of that stuff. And they called it Harmony because they got everybody to come back to the table because there were like doubts that maybe even anything would happen. And so there was this Harmony era from maybe 2008 to 2014, I would say. And then in 2015, this is ES6, right? Is it ES6 is what we called it?
Yeah.
I don't know that anybody uses the ES terms anymore, right? Do they?
I mean, it's getting more and more phased out these days.
Yeah.
But people still use ESNext as like a stand-in for the newest JavaScript.
But ES6 was the biggest set of changes like to JavaScript. It also like I think formalized some of the structure of things. Then I think after 2015 things began to change to not take big things generally, right? Like not the whole language as a big thing, at least. Is it right?
Yeah. The process evolves to sort of avoid any such big changes because it's impossible, I guess, to make up your mind about this, which is why Harmony was so difficult. But yeah, I think apart from Temporal, which is, you know, unique in a way that people were motivated uniquely for Temporal, I think any changes of that size are just infeasible and politically impossible at this point.
But I think it's more than just whether the feature is big. What I'm emphasizing is that there isn't a, like, we're going to draw a box around these and this is exactly what we're going to have in it. And like, well, if we can't get it done until 2029, oh well, you know, like that's just because the whole thing sinks or swims that way, right? But I think part of that is like a realization that that's not really how it works, right? Like individual features sink or swim. I think that's an interesting change, like to just recognize the reality of that. And I think even the stages model is interesting because you also gave these abstract terms for progression. But they're just simple numerics and they don't, maybe they're nicely ambiguous is what I'm trying to say. Like, Eric, maybe you get what I'm trying to say. Like CSS is a thing we could compare against, right? So CSS follows W3C rec track process. And so like you get like first, like you get an editor's draft, a first public working draft, mm-hmm. a right? Like there are several mm-hmm. aspects of stages, and at what point is it real? Do you know what I mean? Like I don't know that
in practice. Well, my experience, this is not going to be universal. Different things will have different experiences, but my experience in the CSS working group is that you have the editor's draft, which is sort of the, you know, it's the first cut. It's the, hey, we have an idea. Let's scribble some stuff down to more or less degree depending. And then you go through a number of working drafts. After the first, there's the first public working draft, but then there's sort of an iterative process. It's like, okay, well, we've been looking at this and the working group needs to decide how this thing interacts with another CSS spec. Once it starts to get close to candidate recommendation, I think is when specs tend to start to become real. Because you do eventually have something go up for candidate recommendation. And that's really the point where interoperability is like invited. Implementation is invited and then interoperability is invited. You know, there may already be implementations by the time you hit that point, in which case it tends to go faster. Unless, of course, in the candidate recommendation phase, it's discovered, oh, man, there's a major flaw in this design and we have to go back to the drawing board and overhaul whole parts of this. Like sometimes candidate recommendations go back to the working draft phase. Like it's not a one way process necessarily. So that's, I think, where CSS specs at least start to get real, is when you're either at or getting close to the candidate recommendation stage. Because within the working group, like, you know, it'll be said, part of the discussion will be, I feel like our next working draft is the last one before candidate rec, unless something comes up. And so that
thing that I like about talking to people is that, like, sometimes somebody says something that you weren't expecting, and then you're like, oh, like, mental note. And like, we're going to maybe fork this into like three different ways I wasn't anticipating going into this. But like, so, just to tie it back to ECMA quickly, is it possible? I don't know that I've never even thought of this, but can you go backwards?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, in this upcoming meeting, a notable proposal, decorators, is going back in stages. So yes, you can. As I mentioned, like it's a sort of public symbol or a publicly shared indicator for how stable or how mature or how far along a proposal is. And fortunately, sometimes we push something along and realize a bit too late that it's not finished. So, you know, it's safer to just push it back a little bit and revisit the topic than keep going with it.
Yeah. So going back to CSS, the other thing that you made me think of that I totally had spaced on, I mean, not spaced on, but like was not in any of my process of thinking, was the thing that I was trying to say is like, say selectors level, pick your level. Like that as a spec doesn't sink or swim as a spec. It's the individual selectors that individually sink or swim. And that's the sort of like comparison that I was trying to make, is that very often the, like whether something is editor's draft or rec or whatever, is like ultimately not the important thing. The important thing is like what is implemented. And then I was thinking, well, we do our best to keep making smaller and smaller, more discrete specs, which is also a change, you know, since we're talking about these changes, because once upon a time, there was just CSS 1 and CSS 2, right?
Yeah. CSS specifications used to be monolithic, but that's because they were much smaller. CSS does have quote unquote monoliths. It has yearly snapshots, which is basically, here's a list of all of the specifications and the like level that we regard as being part of this year's snapshot. So selector 6 might be at candidate recommendation phase, but it's not going to be in the yearly snapshot. The latest basically recommendation, usually it's, again, things are a little you know, a little fuzzy because humans are involved. But yeah, that's as close as we get. But yeah, if you tried to take all of the CSS modules, which is what we call them, the individual specifications, and put them into a single tome, it would be enormous. It would be probably several thousand pages. This is a lot of work for just one working group to do, let alone an entire standards development organization.
Yeah. This goes back a little bit to this era when the W3C was new and like definitely didn't know what it was doing. It was making recommendations that weren't standards, but people began treating them as standards, and it was very consensus driven. And there was definitely this impression, it seems to me, that like to an extent, if we come to these groups, if the group agrees, then it's going to get done. And this is another aspect of mental note in the things that you were saying. Like there are things that are rec or things that are, you know, candidate recommendation or like that have implementation in like zero browsers. That's, I think that's something that's confused people a lot over the years. And like, I think it's something we're still learning how to deal with. I do think that people are still confused by what is real and not. I guess this is probably possible in ECMA as well. Are things ever marked as like stalled, or is it just like just has no energy right now? Let's just keep waiting.
Yeah, there's an explicit sort of state for that kind of, you know, like signaling this is stalled for real, not just slowed down. But the way we call it the archive, though, and unfortunately, as it is a bit more of a graveyard than, you know, the icebox.
There is definitely this thing that I've seen happen in ECMA where it's like, ooh, this thing is coming because it's stage one or two or maybe even three.
And then the problem starts.
And then, yeah, like, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah. And like, it's not clear to people if something is coming or if it's done or if it's like, where is this at? I think we could deal with more things like baseline, which focus on like reality, which kind of ties me back to this era that we were talking about where like nothing was happening. W3C was like, had this impression that you bring people together. And if we talk about it in this group, we can make it happen. They, you know, we're down this other like XHTML, XForms, like XSLT. Everything was, you know, XML based. And meanwhile, the web was like web developers were making incredible things with the same web that hadn't changed in, you know, years. And that led to this meeting in 2004. Which led to the split and creation of the WHAT working group to continue an iteration of HTML in the browsers. And so it was this like, and what's interesting though is like, it seemed like it was maybe not a permanent thing, but like, this is how we get it back on track. And then in 2007, there was an effort to bring it back to the W3C. And from like 2011 to 2018, there was like this two popes. Like, do you know about the history of like the two popes? Like, it's very much like that. Like, there's like the W3C HTML spec and the WHATWIG HTML spec. And like, they had different editors and they sometimes would disagree. And so like, one of the things that was interesting about WHATWIG and the split was that they were like, look, you got to convince implementers. They have budgets and they have all these practical constraints and everything. And like, if two implementers agree, we can get it done. Like, let's write down what people really do, not the thing we hope that they will do. It's very loose, though, like the WHATWIG. It has like, they didn't even have any formal meetings. You know, like everything was just done online. The editor was kind of like superpower. It was very like rough consensus and running code oriented, like IETF, you know. And in 2017, Apple, Google, Mozilla, Microsoft all finally helped put together like a real structure with a steering group and IPR policy, which is wild to think about that we didn't get that until 2017, right? And I think part of that is because in 2019, then we came to like a memorandum of understanding with W3C. And now the WHATWG is like the official home of the HTML and the DOM standard. I didn't even realize, but do you know that the WHATWG now lists 22 standards?
I did not.
And also just in the past year or two, they started having actual meetings, triage meetings, where you can go and talk to get the implementers together to talk to each other. It's basically like a working group meeting, except that it's just like, well, it's about HTML and anything that touches HTML. And they started doing crossover meetings too, where like, well, HTML and CSS touch each other, so we should make sure that HTML and CSS have a joint meeting every now and then. And doing that with a couple of groups, OpenUI especially, which is another development along the way.
So how does WHATWG do their thing? Like, how do they keep it going? Because my understanding is it's not really an official organization. I mean, it's official, but it's not like a formal organization from what I can tell.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating as well, because, you know, even W3C until 2 years ago or so, I might be wrong on that because like sometimes time blurs together, but until very recently was not actually like there wasn't an organization, W3C, like a legal entity. It was like just a collective fiction of agreements between basically colleges that hosted people for W3C and collected money on behalf of the joint thing. It was like not actually entirely dissimilar, except the collected money part. ECMA also collects money,
yeah,
right?
So ECMA has a fixed like fee structure for all of its members, and it hasn't been increased for a while, so I don't want to jinx it, but yeah, there's different member levels, and based on the involvement that you need in sort of the non-technical issues, you can pay appropriately.
Do you know what the max rate is?
70,000 Swiss francs. So this is like approximately a little less than 90,000 US dollars.
Okay. W3C also collects money. Their top rate is, I think, 77,000. WHATWG doesn't collect any money. So what do they do with the money? I mean, this is a question I think a lot of people are curious about, right? Like, what does ECMA do with the money? They have, I think ECMA has just like a couple of employees, right?
ECMA has a number of employees, including the Secretary General and a few others, like, you know, people doing the administrative stuff. I think most of the rest of their money is spent either on infrastructure and sort of organizing it. But yeah, it's a good question. And I think, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of transparency regarding the exact sort of the specifics of how they spend their money. But this is like my understanding.
Yeah, I don't know. And to be clear, it's not a criticism of any of these organizations. But W3C spends its money on all kinds of things. I don't know that it's necessarily all the stuff that membership would like it to spend money on. But, you know, like it has team contacts for each working group, although that's not universal, which is really interesting. So it's like not obviously required. I also think it sort of sends a signal about how important anybody thinks your working group is if it doesn't have a team contact. But, you know, then it has a travel budget for like, well, this team that you have a person on a working group, they have a face-to-face. So you have to go to the face-to-face. And like CSS working group has 4 face-to-face meetings a year, ideally. W3C has a lawyer. It has like infrastructure. It's not great, but they have very nice integration that people wrote over the years for like bots that do useful things that they maintain. They have their own mailing lists that people do still use. They have a Slack channel. They have all of the voting infrastructure. They have the website. You know, there's actually quite a lot there. They have the what's the thing that we all used to use a lot, and now I haven't used in a long time. The validator, right? They have, you know, a CEO and a CFO now, and because they are a legal entity. It's interesting because, like, you say, like, ECMA has infrastructure, but, like, who hosts Test 262? Is it ECMA?
Now a little bit better, but no. So originally Test 262's infrastructure by and large was owned by Boku, who are sort of our allies in this space, and have worked in this for a long time. Then we took on this work after they left TC39 for the most part. And yeah, like it's basically co-maintained by folks who care about it. And that's pretty much it. Like, this is something that ECMA could contribute to, but unfortunately it's too specific to TC39 for ECMA to like intervene directly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, for point of comparison, W3C also doesn't host web platform tests, but they do spend money on helping maintain and build things that have to do with web platform tests, but they don't pay for the hosting or the infrastructure or any of that kind of stuff. W3C also, I forgot to say, has DevRel that do a good job, and they have lots of community outreach. So they have, like, you know, the whole thing built with the host models was in part also to be a, like, a center of gravity. There's stuff in, so yeah, you know, Asia, Europe, US currently are kind of like the big three. But they also don't do, there was an attempt for it at one point, but they don't host the documentation for the web. They contribute, I think, sometimes to the writing of the documentation. They contribute to like BCD oriented stuff, baseline, those discussions, helping organize them and stuff like that. But nobody pays for studying the web. We do have like HTTP Archive and like Web Almanac and all that kind of stuff, but nobody pays for any of that.
Well, I mean, with those are Google projects, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously these things all exist, so somebody is paying for them. But the point is, it's not one of the standards development organizations.
Mm, okay,
so
got it.
It's not collectively funded. You know, yeah. It's like a champion funds it. But then, you know, what happens if that champion suddenly can't afford to, or
changes priorities, or,
you know, a good example is we let Mozilla just have it, you know, we'd be like, okay, well, I'll do it at MDN because Mozilla is the only foundation here. They're trustworthy, you know, and they employ staff writers. So cool. We'll also help out, but great. But then we learn to depend on them to host it and then to have the staff writers. And then suddenly they lay it off the staff writers. And it was like, we had to create open web docs.
Right.
Which is a way to collectively fund it, which there could have been a way to collectively fund it if that's the sort of thing that these organizations did, you know?
Yeah. And open web docs is not an SDO, is not developing standards. It's more of an SDO in the sense of a standards documentation organization.
Right.
But it's trying to fund salary for three or four people and takes it a lot less than, for example, ECMA or the W3C, which, you know, we talk about how much money those organizations take in, but like Ujjwal said, ECMA's membership fees haven't changed in a very long time, like literally a generation. They haven't.
Oh, yeah. 25 years for in the case of
ECMA.
ECMA.
Yeah. And the W3C hasn't raised them in 13 years.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you run the the non-constant dollar calculation when you do the adjusted for inflation calculation, those organizations have taken huge pay cuts over the period of not changing their fees. Even though they're still taking in the exact number of dollars, those dollars don't buy as much anymore.
The one thing that we left off of what W3C does is TPAC, which is actually a really huge deal, in my opinion. And like a bunch of these things, like what we kind of free rides on, right? They the same people are involved in both in a sense. And so like, WTWG has meetings at TPAC. You know, you can use the fact that W3C organized all that stuff.
And I presume somebody's donating their infrastructure as well for WTWG, like hosting, for example.
Hosting for the website?
Yeah, the website, the standards. I mean, they got to live somewhere on the web. So
I assume that it is actually just GitHub hosted at this point. It was for many years, famously, because this was a thing where Hixie was very proud of the fact that he he had a DreamHost account that cost $20 a month. And that was like, he just paid for the whole thing out of his own pocket, as opposed to, you know, paying all these big companies paying into one pool, you know? Okay. But it is interesting, the thing that you were just talking about how they've taken a pay cut. And I wonder, it would be interesting to look at the membership over time and stuff like that, and see how much money they took in 13 years ago versus how much money they take in now.
That's a good point.
I can, on the ECMA side, I can say for sure that they have bled essentially over the years, as you can see. Ordinary members, which is the highest tier of paying members, and to some extent even total members. I think it's a relevant point. I think in some cases the organizations are specialized, but I mean, in some cases it's just less involvement. So would be interesting to see how much less money they get now versus in the heyday.
Yeah. I mean, even if they had kept exactly the same number of members at each level, over a generation, didn't you run the numbers, Brian, on what percentage?
I did. Yeah, I did. So ECMA's taking in, for each dollar that it took in, it's taking in about 46% less value.
So what a dollar would have, or sorry, what 52 cents would have bought when they started, you would now cost a dollar.
Yeah. Something like that.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the W3C
is about 40% still about.
COVID did a number on inflation, and
some of these things are really hard to compare apples to apples too, because they're not equal. So W3C has this concept, has always had this concept of wide review. And so it has, you know, the ARIA working group and Ping and Sing, the security and privacy interest groups. And, you know, WTWG doesn't currently have those things. And so I don't like to use the word free rides, but you get what I'm saying, right? It's not a criticism. It's just borrowing these things from W3C.
Some things, and a lot of the work, a lot of the core work gets done by people who are paid by companies to, in many cases, do that work or devote significant portions of their time to that work. W3C has people. There are people who work at companies, but their job is basically W3C rep or something like that. So they both benefit from that, but I think WTWG probably benefits from it a lot more.
It's also worth noting that W3C does employ people in areas of internationalization and accessibility to have experts that don't work for one of those companies and is more involved than in CSS. I guess they used to have that with Chris Lilly at CSS, but for quite a long time, he's step back to just the team contact. And
yeah, all that taken, you're still, both of these organizations, W3C and ECMA, are trying to do a lot more with less. I mean, they may have more literal dollars, but those dollars do not go as far, right? So, and they may have fewer literal dollars, like, I don't know, but whatever, however many dollars they have, those dollars do not buy what they used to. And so I find it fascinating that both of these organizations have just never even tried to raise. Well, I don't know if they haven't tried.
Well, W3C has raised in the past. I mean,
in the past, you know. Right. But not for 13 years. And
yeah.
And in the case of ECMA, not for 25 years. And it's interesting that like they, as far as I, like they don't even have a structure that says, okay, each year membership fees will go up by whatever the global average inflation was, or something,
or regionalized even, right?
Like it
even
could be regionalized, but if you wanted to make it sort of simple, just be like,
well, they're not they are regional prices already.
Okay.
So you
could do it. You could do it that way too. But whatever thing it is you pick to say, hey, the cost of living goes up.
Totally.
The cost of operation therefore goes up. Therefore, we're going to peg that, like, we're going to make increases pegged to this thing, as opposed to, geez, it's been 13 years. Everyone's gotten real used to it, or 25 years, and everyone's gotten real used to it. How do we even broach the subject of, hey, maybe we should just raise them a little, just a bit. Because if you wanted to recapture all of that all at once, right, you would need to, in ECMA's case, you would need to effectively double all of the membership fees. And that would probably be difficult for representatives to sell to the companies that fund them. Some of them, anyway.
ECMA is having difficulty maintaining the members it already has.
Exactly.
That's, right. That's the challenge. And I think... I'm curious, I did look at sort of membership in the past versus now. Like, is there some way you could see who in 1998 was a big deal that's just no longer participating? You know, when I say big deal, I mean like big company that would send multiple people, would be involved in multiple standards, like took positions, was engaged, you know. And there are a number of them that I think we lost through capitalism more than anything else. So, you know, companies that were acquired by other companies and then they don't both pay a fee anymore, you know, and maybe they're still involved, maybe they're not, but now they only pay the one fee. Or, you know, the rules prohibit you from doing that. And so they just don't participate, like only one of them participates. Do you see that kind of stuff too in the history? Do you know?
Yes, and I have seen a handful, not too many, thankfully, but a handful of members also leave or drastically reduce their involvement. In front of me, I think one I can mention is Meta. I think Meta in the last couple of years sort of refocused away from web technologies, or at least investing so much in web technologies, because by the time that I got involved, I mean, they had React and they were like, you know, in one way or another, quite involved in the JavaScript ecosystem and like, you know, the direction it would take through different technologies. I think that there is very little incentive or willingness within the organization to like really invest a lot on web technologies at this moment. And so, yeah, I think this is like the counterpoint to sort of Eric's proposal, which is like, I guess it's very difficult when you're like losing members or to one thing or another. I think it can feel pretty difficult to sort of justify raising the dues with the idea that like that might cause you to hemorrhage even more. So Yeah, I think it's a difficult problem. There's also, I think, Oracle, for example, used to be more involved, for example. Mm. So I think there's different things. I think there's corporate strategy, and then there's also just capitalism, mergers, all of these things, which means that there's, in some cases, less diversity in the committee.
Oh, competition even. Like it, so in 1998, Netscape was a member, AOL was a member, you know, like there are these companies that they're just not even, basically don't exist anymore, you know. I don't know. I get the sense that people are really questioning the value of paying big money to standards organizations, and they're, part of the reason they're doing that is they're looking at things like WCAG and open source, but I don't know that they're like exact equivalents, and that like if you try to move everything from the W3C into WCAG, that you don't inevitably recreate some of the same problems. You know, I think we've talked about this a bunch of times. We like, whenever there's a revolution, people are like, I hate the old thing. Like inevitably you end up recreating parts of the old thing, right? Because there's probably some reason that they were the old thing.
Yeah, usually. We're back to Chesterton's fence, as we've, I think, discussed on this podcast before. I will consider allowing you to remove the fence if you can tell me why it was put there in the first place.
Yeah.
So
at the same time, I do think that W3C needs to change. Like its processes, I mean, I know there are very good people who work on the process document and stuff like that. I think that there were some really positive changes in the past year where they really sort of asked, like came around and tried to force discussions. Cause that's a thing that's difficult at W3C, is actually getting people to discuss things among the membership, because the membership is, in theory, it's a membership organization. So we could change whatever we wanted. And the trouble is that the process is very cumbersome compared to WCAG. So there even have been recently requests, surprising ones, along these lines in a way. Like Mozilla recently suggested bringing some W3C work over to WCAG for, what is it, like web, Bluetooth, and I mean, it's these things that were part of Project Fugu that Mozilla was before against, and they still probably want significant changes, but they're like, there are reasons we would prefer to bring this over to WCAG, and some of them have to do with like the process and bottlenecks that occur in W3C. And I think some of those criticisms are valid. There are theoretically good things, very good things in W3C, like wide review, but in practice they frequently happen too late. They're missed because there's too much noise. And I think in all of these, that's the thing we got to figure out, because at the end of the day, everybody's most precious resource is time, right? Like, it's like, we got to get everybody to work together. That means we have to find common ground about what to spend our time on. And to me, this is where things like interop are super, super valuable, because that's exactly what it does. It's like, how do we find a way to agree on some things? Like, maybe not everything, but like in really important practical ways, let's focus on these things this year. I don't know. Those are my thoughts.
I mean, it makes sense.
I think it's also worth thinking about, like, how much do we want membership in this way? I don't know what the lookout for ECMA is, but I can tell you that it's very much like a progressive tax system, in that it's like the people who pay the most carry the most of the burden, right? So like, you know, because the prices are progressive and they're almost like an order of magnitude difference, like you have to add a lot of small, like a really lot of small organizations to equal one big one, you know? And so, you know, you could be like, well, there's 52 organizations, and like, but there's really three major organizations worth of pay in there, you know? So I think it's worth thinking about how we restructure those, because the way this works in WCAG is also like web platform tests and stuff like that, where, yeah, there are chairs, there are people who spend extra time and resources on this and organizing it, and those are just paid for by like Google. Just back to this point about like the evolution, the constant evolution, there is also a proposal from somebody at Google for WCAG to change the policies regarding stage advancements to include not just implementers. So like they want to include, you know, like if you have somebody who's an accessibility expert that is invited but doesn't work for an organization, then that should, like, we want them to be able to vote. But it's interesting because the thing that W3C, that WCAG is different about them is that it is more grounded in the practical, you know? And so I don't know. I see them evolving kind of more toward one another in a weird way. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. I would like to hear what people write in about, and like just write to us, ping us on social media, email us, find us on Discord, whatever, and like tell us, what do you think, like how do you think it should work, and what do you think that these orgs should do with money collected? What are things that are not being done that should be done? What are ways that we should be spending our collective power? Well, one thing that I really like, just as a last final note before we go, is Microsoft used to do this exercise where like Microsoft would go to their internal partners and say, here's like 500 fake dollars, you know, like that's what you have to spend. And here's the costs of all these things, you know? So, you know, you can't have all of them, you know, like you have to pick, you can only pick one because they all cost $500, or maybe this one costs $1,000. So you can't buy anything for 2 years if you buy that, right? Somehow like grounding in reality, I would like to see like pools of money where you could use that to say like, okay, us 12, whatever, publishers, math people, gaming companies, you know, whatever, who don't make a browser and all want our own things. Clearly we're not getting them. Here's a pool of money that we can use to like advance one of those things in implementation sense. And the fact that there is money and they have to choose somehow would ground that, you know? Maybe it doesn't have to be like even real money. Maybe there are ways to just change that in the stages process or something, to like ground it in something concrete, to force people to say, I want you all to get your thing, but we can't do everybody's thing. So like, which thing are we going to do? You know, anyway, I think this was a really fun topic. I think it would be really interesting to see where all this goes in the next several years. And maybe when we see another SDO spin out of all these, who knows? And these are not the only ones. There are more, and they work even more differently. So yeah, thanks.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.